This is the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey. It's the 50th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising against China, and Tibetans still make the treacherous journey across the Himalayas into exile.
Fortunately, we ran into some yak traders going to Nepal. They put our packs on the yaks and helped us cross the mountains.
In Sierra Leone, a woman scoops clay from a swamp. What's the clay for?
I just feel like eating it. The craving overcomes me.
And in Jamaica, the craving is for something entirely different, ackee and saltfish.
Well, we always have this for breakfast, especially on a Sunday morning, and a cup of chocolate.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Diane Toomey. First, this hour's news.
Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey in for Peggy Waymire. Have you received an email from a Nigerian prince asking you to wire money to his bank account? You're not alone. Even Citibank fell for one of the scams. Last October, the bank sent $27 million to a Nigerian con artist. It's since recovered the cash. But a lot of that famous Nigerian corruption takes place inside the country. In 2007, the watchdog organization Transparency International rated Nigeria the 32nd most corrupt country out of the 180 it investigated. That was actually an improvement. Nigeria used to be in the top 10. Maybe what's helping is a government effort that enlists the help of the Nigerian people. Richard Locke reports.
Hanging on the wall above Akeem Lawal's desk is a poster that reads, "Corruption is evil." Appropriate for the man who's helping to stamp it out in Nigeria. Lawal heads up the Lagos State branch of the Independent Corrupt Practices Commission. The ICPC is a nationwide initiative to fight corruption. And to do that, Lawal depends on tips, like the text message that's just hit his cell phone.
It says, "Good morning, sir. The major road that
It says, good morning, sir. The major road that enters Badagry is being renovated."
The informant goes on to say that police officers are demanding money from motorists while they sit stuck in traffic on the outskirts of the city.
Some police officers are therefore making fast corrupt money.
Some police officers, therefore, are making some fast corrupt money.
Please do something.
The message comes from a member of Nigeria's recently established anti-corruption volunteer corps. The sender, Lawal says, regularly informs him of police extorting money from motorists. Lawal has to send this tip to his headquarters in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, and await orders from there. In this instance, he says, they might launch a sting operation. The volunteer corps is meant to give all Nigerians, from middle-income professionals to impoverished street vendors, a part to play in the anti-corruption drive.
This anti-corruption crusade is not for ICPC.
This anti-corruption crusade is not for the ICPC alone. It is for all Nigerians, in as much as it affects all Nigerians. We are saying, own it. What we get out of it is in the interest of all.
Nigeria consistently ranks as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. In reaction to that, former President Olusegun Obasanjo put the volunteer corps in place during his last days in office a little over a year ago. Volunteers are encouraged to report any and all instances of corruption, from a police officer soliciting bribes to government ministers embezzling public funds. Anyone, he says, can be a volunteer.
What qualifies you, first of all, is that you are...
What qualifies you, first of all, is that you are Nigerian and you are passionate about fighting corruption.
To protect his sources, Lawal refuses to divulge the names of any volunteers, but he does point to a number of non-governmental organizations that have publicly signed up as members of the volunteer corps. Across the city, in a windowless office, Taiwo Konibagbe runs one of them. It's a local NGO called Exodus 2000, a human rights watchdog.
I have my interest of joining for the mere fact that I've seen...
I have my interest in joining from the mere fact that I've seen a lot of people that are affecting this society, and I want the situation to change. That is why I joined hands so as to see an end to corruption. We want to fight it.
One case he recently reported involved a robbery victim who had to pay the government prosecutor to press charges against his assailant.
It's not the complainant that will now come and pay.
It's not for the complainant to pay out of his own pocket. What if he hasn't got enough money? How is he going to get the law enforced?
You might think this government-led initiative is a bit like the fox guarding the hen house, but the ICPC insists, as its name suggests, that it's an independent body. I witnessed a bit of Nigerian corruption for myself while doing this story. One of the most common forms of petty corruption here in Nigeria are police bribes. Well, somewhat ironically, given the story, my vehicle was just pulled over at a police checkpoint. As my fixer, local journalist Sam Olukoya, stepped out of the car, he murmured, "Don't worry, they just want to extort some money." And sure enough, a small sum of cash is exchanging hands right now. It's the usual practice. This is exactly the sort of corrupt practice the ICPC hopes its vanguard of so-called foot soldiers will stamp out. But not everyone has bought into the bottom-up approach. Femi Akinbode is the kind of man the ICPC would love to have on board. He's young, a well-educated professional who works for an environmental lobby group. But he thinks the commission won't be able to catch the big fish because they're too powerful and well-connected.
You see somebody wiping off almost the budget of a whole state. I mean, that is what is impacting directly on poverty, that is impacting directly on infrastructural level in the country. I mean, you can't then equate that with a policeman standing by the road collecting 20 naira.
Akinbode says he won't get involved in the anti-corruption campaign because he simply can't trust the ICPC to watch his back should he inform on someone.
They need to convince us that, look, I am protected. You know, because in Nigeria, there is the issue of, you know, big manism. You know, that when you report somebody very big in the society, the guy set up the police after you. I mean, you then be the person that is in jail instead of the man that has committed the crime.
Back at the ICPC office, Akeem Lawal acknowledges such concerns, but says they're unfounded.
People fear repercussions, no doubt, but you can report to us anonymously.
People fear repercussions, no doubt, but you can report to us anonymously. Your name need not be disclosed, so you don't have to be afraid to report on your colleagues.
Lawal says he doesn't know how many tips have resulted in corruption convictions, but he adds the way to assess the project's success so far is by the thousands of people signing up to be volunteers. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Lagos, Nigeria.
It's not uncommon for pregnant women to have cravings for odd foods, but in Sierra Leone, the cravings can be for something most people would consider inedible. Grant Fuller reports.
On the banks of a swamp, Kadiatu Fofona stomps her feet in a small crater filled with watery clay. Splotches of dried mud are caked onto her arms, legs, and cheeks. Kadiatu leaves the clay to drain. Later, she'll carry it to a small clearing for a crucial step in the process.
We add salt and medicinal herbs, she says. That's because people like to eat this clay.
That's right. This clay is meant to be eaten. Tiny balls of the hard, dry clay, called wujo, are very popular among pregnant women in Sierra Leone. At the bustling food market in the town of McKinney, neat piles of clay rest on rickety tables, surrounded by a variety of herbs and spices for sale. The clay is sold as food, no different from the stacks of potatoes and eggplant nearby. Pregnant women buy them from me, says a market seller. Some of them buy up to 20 dozen balls of clay. The clay sells for about 3 cents a dozen, making it affordable for most pregnant women here. The astounding amount of clay on every other market table is proof that clay eating is very prevalent in the area. The practice of eating clay, called jiafaji, still exists in many parts of Africa, India, Haiti, and even pockets of the southern United States. Theories suggest that pregnant women especially crave clay because of nutrients and minerals contained in the soil. Still, jiafaji is considered a rare eating disorder in most developed countries. Here in McKinney, however, clay eaters are the norm, and the topic hardly raises an eyebrow. Rugiatu Kagbo, a midwife at a local hospital, says clay's popularity has to do with more than a simple craving.
It's a tradition that passed down. Because even those primates, that's the first.
It's a tradition that's passed down, she says, because even with the first pregnancy, they've seen others eat it, and so they try it themselves. A few dozen mothers gather in a spacious gazebo at a McKinney hospital. They've come to the feeding center to get help for their malnourished babies.
About half of these women ate clay during pregnancy. Most say they simply crave the clay, and many believe it's good for their baby.
I feel better when I eat clay. I don't vomit anymore.
I get benefits back. The skin is strong.
I benefit from eating it. The baby becomes strong and it develops the right way.
I just feel like eating it. The craving overcomes me. So I buy it and eat it.
I eat it to let the bad water out of my stomach so the baby is clean inside the womb. When I eat it, I pee a lot so the bad water comes out.
But what are the health effects of eating clay? That's a topic for debate. A local Red Cross official says the clay causes anemia and constipation as it hardens in the stomach. Others argue it could actually be a cheap source of iron and calcium for impoverished pregnant women. The district's only doctor, Alpha Kamara, says even he's unsure about its effects.
And I've not seen anybody or any doctor or any practitioner in this country have done any study on that.
With such limited knowledge of the subject, the best Dr. Kamara can do is look at the clay's whitish color and presume that it might possibly contain calcium. He says his patients never talk about eating clay, but if he had to venture a guess, he says it probably does more harm than good. So even among medical professionals here, beliefs about the health effects of eating clay are based on speculation rather than research. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in McKinney, Sierra Leone.
Later in the show, we'll hear from an aid worker in Sierra Leone who tried to save a pregnant woman's life. Here's what people in Sierra Leone are listening to right now. The song is called Mr. Government, and it's sung by Cottie Black. She's Sierra Leone's first female reggae star. She's famous for her tough-talking stage personality and using her music to fight for social justice. In this song, she addresses the lack of education and opportunity for young people in Sierra Leone. Up, child refugees cross the Himalayas. That's right after the break. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey in for Peggy Waymire. It's been 50 years since Tibetans rebelled against Chinese rule. Last year, on the anniversary of the uprising, anti-Chinese protests rocked the region. Now the Chinese are out in force in Tibet, trying to prevent a repeat of last year's violence. Tibetans have been fleeing Chinese control for decades. Thousands have poured into northern India. Many of the refugees who cross the Himalayas are children, often sent by their parents. Will Everett reports from Dharamsala, home of the exiled Tibetan government.
Tenzin Dasse is a 17-year-old with a shy smile and a passion for homework. She walks into the small but homey bedroom that she shares with a roommate.
This is my bed.
Handmade posters cover the walls. They're filled with slogans reminding her to study hard and not make excuses. They're written in English, which she's just started learning. Dasse is in the 11th grade. Not exceptional for a girl her age, but she only started going to school 4 years ago.
I lived in a poor part of Tibet where most people are farmers. Until I was 13, I never went to school. My parents were simple people who didn't know how to read or write, so they couldn't teach me.
They also had poor medical care in her village. When both of her parents and a younger sister died from illnesses, Dasse was left virtually alone. Her only surviving sister lived far away and was too poor to care for her.
When my parents and sister died, it was a huge mental shock. I thought, I've got to get away from all this tragedy. I begged my brother-in-law to send me to India, but he was very poor. Finally, when he saw that I was serious, he sold a yak and used the money to send me to India.
Going to India is the dream of many Tibetans, particularly northern India, which the Dalai Lama has called home for nearly half a century. Dasay joined a group of half a dozen others making the trip. One was a young man from her village named Jume, who had been to India before. The journey through Nepal and across the Himalayas took nearly 2 months.
We walked mostly at night. If we encountered people along the way, we told them we were pilgrims going to Mount Kailash, a holy Buddhist site.
Traveling at night, they sometimes wandered into Chinese army patrols camped near the border, risking possible arrest and imprisonment. But winter had come, and the real threat was the weather.
We walked along the frozen rivers. I kept slipping in the ice and snow, but my friend helped me each step of the way. Fortunately, we ran into some yak traders going to Nepal. They put our packs on the yaks and helped us cross the mountains. When our food ran out, they gave us some of theirs. If it weren't for them, I don't know if we would have made it.
But they did make it, arriving at the Tibetan children's village in Dharamsala 3 years ago. Many, like Tenzin Dasay, arrive here as orphans. But most of the 2,000 children here are sent by parents who stay behind in Tibet. It's a treacherous journey, but crackdowns by the Chinese government have made it difficult for Tibetans to learn about their culture and religion. Parents hope a life in Dharamsala will provide children with that education, though once they arrive here, most never see home again.
Our organization is not only an educational organization, but we play a parental role also.
Thupten Dorje is director of the children's village.
Over 70% of these children have their parents back in Tibet, which means they have no connection or no information or in touch with their parents back in Tibet. So they are more or less totally under our care.
Fog rolls in over the mountainside as a group of teens play soccer on a muddy field. It's a drizzly day, but the team wants to be ready for next week's playoff between students and teachers. We're going to win, the boy says. We're not great, but we're going to work harder than the teachers. Working hard is a running theme here. Like Tenzin Dasay, most children arrive here far behind in their schooling. Some cram several years of study into a single year. Those who reach a certain grade point go on to university, paid for by the TCV. Those who don't make the grade have the option of learning a trade. Tenzin shares a cottage with about 40 other boys and girls. Because it's Saturday, they're allowed to watch TV. Today, it's the American vampire thriller Blade. The kids lie on the floor with their chins resting on their hands, utterly engrossed in the movie. Tenzin Dasay would like to be watching it with them. But with tests just around the corner, she's studying 4 or 5 hours a day.
My dream is to become a doctor. I saw so much suffering with my family not having a doctor.
She adds, I don't want to see others have to go through that. For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett, Dharamsala, India.
For Tibetan refugees, crossing the Himalayas is an obstacle on the path to freedom. But for others, the mountains themselves hold an allure. The Himalayas have always been a magnet for spiritual seekers and adventurous backpackers alike. South African Emma Bestall recently trekked in the Himalayas with her hiking partner, Christian. They decided to do things the hard way, without guides or ponies. They stayed in local homes for only a few dollars a night. The hiking trip was supposed to take just 5 days, but as Emma explains, things didn't go exactly as planned.
We arrived at Hanka, which was the third village, on the third night, when the sun was setting and it had started to hail. It was so cold. I think it was 4,200 meters above sea level. And we arrived and we couldn't see anyone around, and then we bumped into an old woman who was wearing a goat sheep skin on her back. We called her Amma, which is colloquial Hindi for grandmother, and she took us to the local homestay. It was her and her daughter, Yan Chen, and her daughter's husband that we lived with. The village had about 4 to 5 mud houses that were very, very scarcely furnished inside, just a big stove where people sleep in winter because it gets so cold, which is minus 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And they get snowed in completely, so they have no access to the outside world for most of the year. We arrived and thought we were only going to stay for one night, and then the next morning Christian was very ill, and I realized that we'd be stuck there for a few days because we just couldn't go over the pass if he was sick. The family didn't speak English at all, except for Yanchan, who was the matriarch of the family. She spoke a little bit. In the evening, we'd sit around the fire, the hot stove in the kitchen, and basically sort of try and communicate with the family, even though we couldn't, and eat the food, which was very strange and very foreign. Lots of yak butter and everything. When Christian was sick, I got pretty bored sitting there in the mountains. So I went with Yanchan to the fields to help her plow them, to see what life was like for a woman in the Ladakhi Himalayas. We went and plowed the fields. Everything was done by hand, and nothing was mechanized at all. We used hand plows and worked the hard ground. It was quite tough. And she would do about 3 fields in the time that I did one. Every day at lunchtime, we'd sit and eat a packed lunch and lie on the soil together and look at the sky, which was a really magnificent blue, and teach each other words in our languages for sky or cloud or rock. We were getting worried that we wouldn't get out of there because Christian was still sick, and even though he was starting to feel better, he was still quite weak. So we waited until the 4th night when Yanchan's husband came home and he had the ponies with him. And we organized with him to have the ponies take us over the pass the next day. We were sitting next to him in the kitchen eating spinach broth that evening. And we started chatting to him because out of the family he spoke the most amount of English. And he looked at me and he said to me, "How many fields do you have at home?" And I looked at him and I was a bit puzzled and I said, "None." And he looked a little bit concerned and sort of looked off into the distance. And then he turned to me and asked me, "And how many sheep?" And I looked at him and I was like, "None." And he shook his head and looked a little bit sad and said, "Oh, well then, here you are very poor." The fact that he looked at me with sympathy as if I was poor in a place where there was no healthcare and no plumbing and you had to work really hard just for one meal did throw me. When we waved goodbye to Yanchan and her family, I paid Yanchan 2,400 rupees, which is the equivalent of $55, for 4 nights for 2 people, board and lodging. And she seemed very unimpressed by the wad of money that she was holding in her hand, which I thought was quite strange, seeing as I imagine it was probably the most money she's ever had at one time. And I just realized that in this tiny village in the middle of nowhere, 3 days away from anywhere where you snowed in for the entire winter, a 50 rupee note is probably as valuable as a square of toilet paper. The things you're going to be counting in the middle of the winter when you're trying to survive the incredible cold are your fields that you plowed and how many sheep you have, and that will determine whether you can survive the winter.
Emma Bestall lives in Cape Town, South Africa. You're listening to the first big hit of a musical group from Israel. The band is called the Idan Reichel Project. The lyrics are in Amharic. That's the language spoken by Ethiopian Jews. More than 70,000 of them live in Israel. They left Ethiopia in the 80s and early 90s to escape harsh conditions there, but they've never been fully integrated into Israeli society. Idan Reichel is doing his part to change that by incorporating Ethiopians and other minorities into his musical group. He spoke with host Peggy Waymire.
I served in the Israeli army as this is our duty. I was lucky to serve as a musician. There was one singer from Ethiopia. I started singing with her. I started to explore with her the roots of her music. But I think the first time that I got to know the music that came here from Ethiopia, when I was working as a counselor in a boarding school, which I guided their immigrants from Ethiopia and from Russia. It was their first early days in Israel. This was the first time that I saw that the Russian community that are coming here to Israel are a very strong community. They keep their own classical roots and they are very proud of their roots. But the Ethiopian community, sometimes they have really, really deep identity problems, and they started to adopt themselves Afro-American names or started to listen to a lot of reggae music. But most of them, you know, they don't feel really proud of their East African Jewish roots.
You were trying to encourage them to get in touch and be proud of their Ethiopian roots while really integrating into Israeli society, and you used your music to help them do that?
Yeah, exactly, because those youngsters, they're struggling and they have so many obstacles. You know, when they come home, their parents in their first early days in Israel, they don't know what electricity is. You know, they just came from the villages, the hardcore villages of East Africa. Once you come here, you know, you're struggling the language and you're struggling the culture. Once you listen to your music for the first time, to your roots on the Israeli mainstream, I think it can make you really, really proud. So, and it can give you hope. So it was very important to me that the lead singers of the project will be from the minorities.
You mentioned when you were serving in the army, you met an Ethiopian singer who sang in the army band with you. And I believe you included her in one of your albums so that you could do this very thing you're talking about now, which is to give the Ethiopian youth kind of a voice in Israeli music.
Yeah, until today, we have around 90 musicians and singers from all over Israel. Few of them I found in the Israeli army as singers in the Israeli army. Some of them are like in underground bars or even I found them in traditional ceremonies all over, just to go out from the house and exploring all over Israel, searching for a lot of talented people. And we ended up with, as I said, 90 musicians. So a few of them are like new immigrants. Some of them are like few generations here in Israel. The youngest is 16 years old and the eldest is 89. We have like 64, 79 years old. It's a very, very big project.
And how many countries are represented in this project?
So basically we have singers from all over, from Yemen, from Morocco, from South America, from Ethiopia.
I'd like to play a song from your second album where we can actually hear an Ethiopian woman singing. And the song is called Nicer Words Than These. Let's listen and then we'll chat about it. Idan, whose voice is that?
Nicer Words Than These, sang by Kabra Kasai. Kabra Kasai, the lead singer of our live show. She was born in the refugees camps of Sudan. I think Kabra Kasai is one of my biggest success. Nowadays, you can listen to her voice all over Israel in the Israeli mainstream radio, and she's my biggest proud.
I understand you're about to go on tour in the U.S. You've released this third album in Israel, and you're just releasing it now in U.S. called Within My Walls. I've listened to the album several times. It's lovely. How would you define this album as unique?
It's the first time that we have singers from all over the world joining this Israeli project. And although they're singing in their own native languages or in their mother language, such as Marta Gomez from Colombia, she sings in Spanish, or Mayra Andrade from Cape Verde, she sings in Creole, still in the melodies you would think that it was written here in Israel, and it sounds very, very Israeli also in the production. So I think this project it's the first time that the Idan Reichel project become a world music project and a worldwide project.
Well, I'd like to pick a song from that album. I'd like for you to choose one that best represents what you're trying to communicate. If there's one that does that, what should we listen to?
I really don't have a favorite, but we can listen to Somi from Rwanda. She sings Maisha. For me, it sounds always like a Eastern European melody, classical melody, but it sings by her beautiful vocal of Somi with her beautiful Swahili. I think it represents the main change of the project.
Well, Idan, thanks so much for sharing your story and your project with us, and we'll look forward to that American tour.
Thank you. It's a great honor for us to be in this show and to bring our music to the American listeners.
That was Idan Reichel. For more information on his music or his upcoming U.S. tour, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. And here's the title song from his new album. It's called Within My Walls. ביתי הכל סגור ונשמע פריע אל מול שתיקת קירות ביתי אין רחש שיכנס כאן בין כל קצוות ביתי אין כל מכשול בכל שבילי החדר אין שמש שישרוף ואין גם צל אשר יחשיך ואין משב סופה ואין גשם שישטוף ואין גם צוהר שיבהיל ואין דבר אשר ישרוף. Cooking with Winnie in Montego Bay. That's coming up on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey in today for Peggy Waymeyer. In Malawi, the expression for pregnancy is pakati. It means in between life and death. It's not surprising that pregnancy is seen that way in the southern African country. 1 in 7 women there dies during pregnancy and childbirth. Joanne Jorison has been trying to improve those odds. She's a nurse who moved to Malawi from Texas 3 years ago to work as a midwife. Jorison is founder of the African Mothers Health Initiative and writes a blog about her experiences as a midwife in Malawi. She spoke with host Peggy Waymeyer.
The environment is difficult, for sure. The hospital where I was volunteering as a midwife is called Bottom, and it's appropriately named. They have 12,000 deliveries in a year, which probably doesn't mean much to most people, but just as a mark of comparison, the General Hospital in San Francisco, where I did my training, they had about 1,200 deliveries in a year.
You had 12,000 deliveries, and how many nurses?
For any one shift, they usually have 3 nurses in the labor ward doing 30 to 50 births a day.
With 3 nurses or midwives?
Yes, 3 nurse midwives.
Can you describe your typical day in this hospital as a midwife?
Well, the midwives here do attend the vaginal deliveries by themselves without clinicians or physicians. Every time I walk into the hospital, I do feel a little bit nervous about what I'm going to find and what might happen throughout the day. You know, you would see more in this hospital in a single day than you might see in a month or a year in a hospital in the States.
What are the challenges each day that you face as a midwife there?
I mean, there's just so many. I guess when you go into the ward, it's a single room with 14 beds, and sometimes the beds are completely full. Sometimes there's women delivering on the floor. And also there's only one theater. So if the theater is occupied and a woman comes in who needs a surgery right away, you have to wait for the woman to finish who's in there, which means that the woman who's waiting, her condition might deteriorate. And it's so difficult to get a grasp on the situation in general with so few people and so limited resources. But I, you know, there's also really beautiful births and really wonderful moments. And I think, you know, that those are the ones that really inspire me and encourage me and feed me to keep on going.
Now, Joanne, you have really utilized technology to tell stories about the mothers and newborns you work with. Why have you chosen this route, this blogging route, to raise money and to tell your story of what you're doing over there?
Well, honestly, I only found out about blog just a couple days before I left for Malawi, and I just thought it would be a good way, an unobtrusive way, to share my stories with friends and family. And I really had no idea that other people would be interested or read my stories at all. A lot of people read my blog, and shortly after I came to Malawi, people started sending money, saying, here's $50, here's $100, here's $200, do something good with this.
And what do you do with it?
African Mothers Health Initiative was a nonprofit that I set up in response to my blog writings. So the very first time I saw a woman die in the hospital and her baby survived, I went to the nursery and I asked them, what is going to happen with this baby? And they said that, you know, the grandmother would take the baby home, and most likely there would be no formula for the baby because formula is very expensive and most of the women who deliver at this hospital are very poor, and most likely the baby would die in a couple of days. So from that point on, I started making a list, having the nursery nurses help me whenever they had babies in there whose mothers either had died or were critically ill and couldn't care for them, that I would meet with the guardians of that baby, the grandparents, the sisters, whoever was going to care for that baby, and then follow that baby at home, provide formula, and just make sure that that baby was healthy.
I wonder if you could read from some of your blog entries. One in particular I noted is titled Punctuation. Could you read us an excerpt from that?
Towards the end of the day, I noticed Ivy crying loudly on the last bed in the room. She labored with her third baby, and a student stood monitoring the baby's heart rate. At bottom, it is unusual for a woman laboring with her third baby to be so vocal. I placed my fetoscope on her belly and heard nothing but her own pulse. I asked two other midwives to check. They also heard nothing. I brought in the ultrasound machine and saw the baby's heart beating slowly, maybe at 40 beats per minute, maybe at 20. I lost hope for the baby, but an emergency C-section was ordered. 30 minutes later, I was handed her baby, a large boy with no pulse. He did not respond to resuscitation. His head was molded in an unusual way, and I thought for a minute that he had been positioned incorrectly inside. But then the clinical officer conducting the C-section told us that the mother's uterus was ruptured. The uterus, even as it was ripping, continued contracting, pushing the baby not out of the cervix, but out of the tear. This mother escaped with her life. I met her sister outside the theater and asked a nurse to explain the situation. She was grateful. She saw the dead child. I went home ungrateful, trying desperately to recapture the joy I felt with Rebecca and her beautiful birth earlier in the day, trying desperately to make her the center and not merely punctuation.
Mm. Hearing something like that, I would think you'd get very discouraged. What motivates you to keep on going?
Well, definitely there are a lot of sad stories, and I have witnessed a lot of sad stories, but I feel that what I've also witnessed is a lot of love and joy. And I think that when you see someone overcome great odds and great suffering, great tragedy, raising their children with immense love, it makes you want to turn away from everything else and jump on board wholeheartedly.
Joanne Jorison, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you so much.
Joanne Jorison is founder of the African Mothers Health Initiative and writes a blog about her experiences as a midwife in Malawi. You can link to it at our website, worldvisionreport.org. The women in Malawi who have access to health care are the lucky ones. Many people in the developing world don't. William Powers knows this all too well. He used to manage a public health program in Sierra Leone run by Catholic Relief Services. He recalls an incident when the scarcity of medical care presented him with an awful choice. He tells us about it in this aid worker diary.
We slammed on the brakes as a villager threw himself in front of our jeep. The girl, he said out of breath, she's dying. I jumped out and followed the man through the village, just a couple hundred mud huts with shiny zinc roofs. As I entered one of them, a sour stench filled my nostrils. The silhouette of a pregnant girl took shape. Her name was Zara. Her big belly looked ready to burst, and bright red bumps covered her swollen legs. The nurse on my team examined her and declared, "This girl is going to die." Zara had a condition that was causing her body to swell up. It threatened the life of both herself and her baby. She needed a hospital with a blood bank, but the nearest hospital staffed with a doctor was a 7-hour drive away. I radioed our office in the state capital for help, but my organization couldn't spare any vehicles. They were tied up in other work, fighting malaria, TB, and AIDS. As for any help from the government, the region's sole ambulance was in Freetown, a 10-hour drive away. Nausea slid from my gut into my chest. I couldn't focus. I felt lightheaded. We were supposed to be heading further upcountry to train traditional birth attendants and distribute bed nets. Palm trees swayed above the hut as I weighed the cost of turning my Jeep back toward the capital. I did the cold arithmetic. In the time it would take me to rescue Zara, I might cause the death of 10 other people. Some would be infected with malaria because I didn't get them a bed net in time. Others would die in childbirth because I delayed training birth attendants. I looked at the girl. She looked back at me through her pain. And I did one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I bent down, touched her scorching forehead, and told her that we had to leave her behind. My voice choked on the words. In the car, heading into deeper rainforest, my conscience had a sour smell, the smell of Zara's room. At that moment, I didn't know there would be a happy ending. I didn't know that later that day, I'd track down a vehicle that would rescue Zara. She would arrive safely at the hospital. All I knew then was how awful I felt. A colleague tried to comfort me as Zara's village disappeared behind us. "It was the best we could do," she said. "You can't always play the hero. If you do, many more Zaras will die." What she told me was true, but it was small comfort.
William Powers is the author of Blue Clay People, Seasons on Africa's Fragile Edge. Now, come with us to the Roadside Grill in Montego Bay, Jamaica. It's a mom-and-pop restaurant built out of an old metal shipping container. Winnie Allen is mom. She's been cooking for her regulars for decades, and one of her most frequent orders is for Jamaica's national dish, ackee and saltfish. Never heard of it? Well, we're told ackee is a fruit that looks like a tiny pomegranate. Saltfish is dried cod. Chop them up and fry them, and you get a dish that looks like scrambled eggs. Reporter Judith Ritter has this latest installment in our What's Cooking series.
Thank you for inviting me to the kitchen.
It's a pleasure. I'm going to do ackee and saltfish, which is our national dish.
That sounds great. I love ackee. I think it's pretty high in cholesterol, but...
Never mind. This is a saltfish. This is the ackee. Okay, I'm getting the ackee together. Just pour it in like this.
Now, the ackee looks like little pieces of yellow fruit.
Some people say it looked like scrambled egg.
Somebody told me that ackee is poisonous on the tree.
When it is not properly open on the tree, it could be poisonous because there's a certain gas that is in there. So, therefore, you have to let it open properly.
Is it a favorite of yours?
Very. I love it. Well, we always have this for breakfast, especially on a Sunday morning, and a cup of chocolate, Jamaican chocolate, the one that you buy in the market, and you grate it, and you boil it with cinnamon and coconut cream.
Now, what you're doing here...
I'm getting the saltfish together. Now I'm going to get my onions. And I'm going to get my tomatoes, nice red tomatoes. And this is my oil here. Pour some oil in this.
So you just poured the oil in. Next step?
Next step is I put my tomatoes. And this is onion, garlic, pepper, tomatoes. Okay. And then I'm going to put the saltfish in. Just pour it in like this.
So that's little pieces of
saltfish.
Yeah, cod?
Cod, you call it codfish. We call it saltfish.
What would it cost for somebody to make a dish like that for themselves at home?
Not expensive. A couple of pieces of saltfish. And most people grow ackee here. Most people have an ackee tree.
So that makes it less expensive.
Okay. Get some black pepper. Then I get a little black pepper.
Sprinkle it.
Right, over it. And then it's ready.
Really? You're just mixing?
That's all it takes. No time. And this snow is normally served like with roast breadfruit and rice and peas or some sweet potato.
So you just mix it up?
Just like that. It's ready for serving now. And beside it is dumpling and yam and some stir-fried vegetables, avocado, and there are gungu rice and peas over there.
There's a song about Aki.
Very popular song in Jamaica. This lady took her Aki to the market, and it was a very bad night. She didn't sell all her Aki, so she was just there singing.
So what did she sing?
Me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Carry me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night.
Okay, I'm going to try this. Here we go. I'm going to try the Aki first. It's just perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and nice to have me. Me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Carry me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night.
Well, after that, I'm sure you want to see photos of Winnie and her Aki and saltfish. We've got some at our website, worldvisionreport.org.
And every day you can hear a shot, get your coconut water. Man, it's good for your daughter. Cocoa got a lot of iron. Make you strong like a lion. Our lady tell me the other day, no one can take this sweet man away.
Earlier in the show, you heard about Tibetan children trekking across the Himalayas to get to India. Reporter Will Everett spent some time in Dharamsala in northern India to report that story. Dharamsala is the Dalai Lama's home in exile. Many Tibetans live there now, including hundreds of Buddhist monks who went in search of religious freedom. Will Everett struck up a friendship with one of them. Here's Will's reporter's notebook.
For a week, I'd watched them drifting through the narrow streets of Dharamsala in their red and yellow robes, lost in thought, alone with their stories. Stories I badly wanted to hear. Then one day, a monk approached me and we started chatting. He wanted to practice his English and wondered if I would come to his cabin up the mountain and converse with him while he made me a traditional Tibetan dinner. Sultram was a shy young man with a round, eager face. He lived a life of Buddhist contemplation in a tiny two-room cabin without running water. I wasn't the first visitor he'd approached to practice his English. His bookshelves attested to the paperbacks his foreign friends had left behind, a collection ranging from Nietzsche to Judy Blume. But he'd started giving his books away. After 4 years in Dharamsala, he was thinking about returning home to Tibet. I realized that this quiet, thoughtful monk had a militant streak. He showed me pictures of himself at protest rallies in Delhi, speaking out against Chinese injustices back home. He wrestled with his calling, whether to live a life of contemplation in keeping with Buddhist teachings, or to go back to Tibet and work in the growing resistance movement. This became a kind of backdrop to our daily English lessons. He liked to use the word journey a lot. He felt that his own personal journey would soon lead him back home. His parents sent him to a Buddhist seminary when he was 8. By the time he was a teenager in the mid-1990s, the Chinese were making sweeping changes in Tibet. Suddenly, he was no longer allowed to wear the traditional Buddhist robes. Many of his teachers were replaced by Chinese officials, and the curriculum was changed to reflect a pro-Chinese agenda. Eventually, Sultram had had enough. One night, he hung a handwritten banner over the seminary gates calling for change. The next day, everyone had to submit a handwriting sample. Sultram fled on foot to Lhasa, but by the time he got there, his photo was already hanging on lampposts, with a reward for information leading to his arrest. He spent the next year and a half in hiding, growing his hair out and moving from one village to another. At last he fled to India, a journey through the Himalayas that took nearly 2 months and nearly killed him. 4 years later, the news from his village was getting worse. Police actions against subversives had stepped up since the Olympics, and Sultram wanted to go back home. The other monks said he should follow the Dalai Lama's example and work for change from the safety of exile. Tsultrim said he felt useless, that his life was wasted in Dharamsala. When I left him, Tsultrim gave me a piece of red string to wear around my wrist. It had been personally blessed by the Dalai Lama, and Tsultrim said it would keep me safe on my journey. I felt that he was the one who would need blessings if he returned to Tibet. I didn't hear much from Tsultrim after I left. Another monk wrote to tell me that he had become depressed and withdrawn. And then I learned that he had disappeared. For weeks I wondered about his whereabouts, and then came a note from Nepal. He said he'd made it to the Tibetan border and would soon slip back into his village. He said I probably wouldn't hear from him for a long time. I don't know what will happen to Tsultrim if he gets caught by the police, as he almost certainly will. He just crossed the Himalayas on foot for the second time, and he's got bigger challenges ahead. But that's his journey. I only hope he's wearing his red string.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. You can see his photos from his trip to India on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can download a podcast of the show on iTunes or at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also read blogs from our reporters around the world, and you can post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. I'm Diane Toomey. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.